Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you have something to say and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details, or contact us at PR@speakuptalkradio.com. And right now, I have two guests to share with you, a husband and wife team, Gail and Dave Hickman from Knoxville, Tennessee. Gail felt the call to write the true life story of a miraculous event that her husband experienced in 1955, when at age 14, while hunting with his grandfather, he found an abandoned baby in the woods of Indiana. His decades-long search to locate her again resulted in their emotional reunion in 2014, which was broadcast worldwide on the CBS This Morning show. Additionally, CBS posted the video on YouTube, and the story of their reunion went viral, as they say, and soon Gail and her husband were receiving responses from individuals from all over the world expressing interest in knowing more about this decades-long search, the reunion, and their personal life. It took 2 years to write the book titled And the Angel Cried, The Miraculous Story of an Abandoned Baby in 1955. Looking back on the events that occurred during the search for baby Roseanne was an extremely emotional time in their lives. The agony of encountering one brick wall after another, one door closing, another opening, and increasing suspicion of a cover-up in Dave's hometown. Anyone who values life will cherish this story. Those who believe or want to believe in divine intervention will be brought to their knees. And I am so looking forward to hearing this incredible story directly from both of them. So welcome to the network, Gail and Dave.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Pat.
Oh, what a pleasure. And thank you for sending me a copy of the book. I just sat there and wept through the entire time. But before we go there, I must say that I'm absolutely blown away by both of your artistic talents. Gail creates polymer clay sculptures, and Dave is an artistic wood turner, and I have to say, both of your work is amazing.
Well, that is very kind of you, Pat. That is one thing that we love doing during our spare time, which hasn't been much lately, but it's been a great little avenue for us to travel for relaxation.
Sure, I bet it got you through a lot of rough times as well.
Definitely.
Yep. All right, well, let's talk about the book And the Angel Cried. This is an incredible true story, as I said, of this event that happened in 1955 when, Dave, you were 14 years old and found an abandoned infant in the woods. Give us just a brief retelling of that story, just enough to entice folks to get a copy of your book so they can find out the entire story.
Okay, that was a very amazing day. There are several newspaper articles out, a lot of different information. But that day, that was Thursday, September 22nd, 1955. My grandfather had called me up about 10 o'clock in the morning. It had rained all night the night before, on Wednesday night, and the temperature was in about 50 degrees. My grandfather picked me up, and we went to this woods. And we had never been to that woods before. Which was very strange to me because we had always hunted the same place on the farm. We had five or six different locations. But anyway, we hunted all day. We came out of the woods about 6 o'clock in the evening. And we were dressing out our game and standing by the car. And something got my attention. And I can't really explain what it was that got my attention as through a sound or tapping on the shoulder or whatever it was. But anyway, I knew I had to find out what was going on. I knew something was wrong. So I started walking along the fence. I was on the roadside of the fence, and I was in mode. In the book, we estimated that I walked about 70 yards, 210 feet. My wife and I were up in Indiana about 3 months ago attending a funeral, and it's through the funeral of one of the ladies that was very instrumental in helping us found the reunion, or the lady. that I found in the woods. But anyway, we measured it out this time, and actually I walked a little bit over the length of the football field. I walked about 120 yards. And I came to a fence post, and I felt I have to climb up the fence post and go into the woods. But I had to stop right there. I climbed up the fence post, and on the other side of the fence, the weeds were very deep, a lot of limbs down, and I looked to find a safe place to sit down, and that's where the baby was lying. The baby was wrapped in just a dirty towel. Her umbilical cord had not been tied. Hmm. She was cut on the barbed wire fence. Her face, arm, and side was cut open. She was bleeding. And she was covered with maggots. Oh. If I had stopped at the fence post before or the fence post afterwards, she would still be there. You couldn't see her from those positions. I called my grandfather and we went and got help.
Wow. Just talk about being at the right place at the right time, that you were supposed to be there. That just is not an accident.
No, I can't help but to feel that I was led to that baby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
120 yards, she could not make a sound. She couldn't cry out. Her lips, hands, and feet were blue. And later on, I was informed by the sheriff that she had been in the woods overnight.
Yeah.
Anywhere for possibly as much as 24 hours. In that 50-degree weather, the rain, there's animals in that woods, fox and coyotes. They didn't get to her, and I was led to her. It had to be that way.
Yes, yes, it obviously had to be that way. What a story and what an experience for a little child as yourself. I mean, a little 14-year-old. And then you carried that with you for the next 58 years. You searched and searched for her. And I just found it so interesting that it seemed like nobody was really working with you or trying to help. I'm sure it felt that way.
A couple of weeks after I found her, I'd ride to the hospital on my bicycle. So from where I live, it's probably about 5 miles away. And I'd go into the hospital and I'd inquire about her. And they wouldn't tell me anything. There were just a few small newspaper articles that came out. And there was not really a lot of information in them. So later on, as we kept searching, it was like a brick wall running into. No one would tell us anything. About 3 months after I found her, I was in class. I was in junior high school, and my teacher came up to me, and she said, "Dave, you have to go to the principal's office." And here I am, a 14-year-old boy, scared to death. I figured they caught me doing something. Of course. Anyway, I walked grudgingly to the principal's office, and there were two nurses there, and they on their own brought the baby to me to say goodbye to. They told me that she was being adopted. They let me hold her, and I got to kiss her goodbye.
Wow.
And then from that moment on, they weren't even supposed to bring her to me.
Mm-hmm.
But they obviously knew how I felt. That I was very concerned that she even lived and couldn't find out any information. So anyway, I got to kiss her goodbye. And from that point on, then we couldn't find out anything. And I still see the image of that baby in the woods. And that's what drove me to find out what kind of life she had or even if she lived.
Yeah, I think anyone in your position would feel the same way. I mean, you saved this little child, and to be denied any kind of information, and I understand privacy, and I don't even know if they had HIPAA laws back then, but, you know, just the whole private aspect of it, but still just to let you know that, yes, she's fine, she's okay. And I was wondering about how some of these circumstances might have been different had it been today. I bet the nurses would never have come to school with this baby had it been, you know, 2017.
I question that too. I think I was very, very honored that they did what they did.
Yes.
And I don't know that that would happen today either. We still hear a lot of stories about babies being abandoned and babies being found in different places. And I don't know. It really concerns me that things like this happen. Of course, I can never understand, never justify in my mind anybody doing what they did.
Yes. No, that's beyond what any reasonable person could even fathom. I also wonder, as I was reading the book, was the secrecy due to privacy issues, or was there some connection somewhere where someone was just withholding this information? I mean, did someone ever know who did this? And then the whole thing with the pink ribbon, that you had tied the pink ribbon on the fence and the next day it was gone. So it seems like somebody was still looking and checking. And
of course, this is attempted murder. There's no question about it.
Yes.
There was always a lot of speculation, a lot of talk that the baby's mother was probably a teenage girl at the time.
Right, that's what I thought.
And her parents were thought to be probably very influential in that area. And we don't know, of course, if the mother threw the baby over the fence into the woods. We don't know if it was the brother, the boyfriend, or anything at this point. But one thing happened just before the reunion, and this is not in the book. I had an attorney call me up here in Tennessee, and the newspapers were already at the information about the reunion. Anyway, he called me, and he said, "Dave, I'm so-and-so, and I'm an attorney, and I wanted to ask you, do you think you can really find that location where you found that baby?" Well, obviously, that's something that you cannot erase from your mind. So when he said he was an attorney, I was very concerned about answering his question. But anyway, he asked me, or he told me, that he was going to send me plot plans of the area. And he wanted me to mark on those plans where I found a baby. He sent the plot plans, and I did not mark on them, and I did not return them to him. But at the reunion, he had invited himself, and he made sure that when everybody was taking a picture of me and the lady, Ellen, that he was in the picture.
Whoa.
Now, an interesting thing about that, at the time that I found the baby, 1955, he would have probably been about 18 and 19 and just going to college.
Interesting.
Now, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting that this took place the way it did.
And did he ever say who hired him, or he was just supposedly had a self-interest in this? I mean, that would have been interesting to find out.
Never any kind of explanation.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really press too much. Mm-hmm. I felt that, it's a terrible thing what Ellen is going through. She's a lovely lady. It was really wonderful to meet her, but for her to have to live with such a thing as knowing that she was going away, that it's up to her to pursue this type of thing.
Mm-hmm. No, I get that. I get that. Yes, and how difficult a life that must be for her. I mean, happy that she's alive, but always questioning what and why and who, and that would be a very difficult way to live a life. And I understand that you had a difficult life as well, trying to figure this out, and it was always haunting you. And once you got married and you told this story to your wife, Gail, did you ever decide prior to meeting this little baby in person a few years ago. Did you ever think about writing about this prior to that?
No. We were very concerned. I felt like I had to find out about her. I just had to find out if she was alive. I wanted to know what kind of life she had. We tried to be very careful in our search. We didn't know if she lived, if she knew her true story. A terrible thing to be thrown away like this. And I didn't want to be the one to inform her.
Right.
If that would be the case. Mm-hmm. So my search and my wife's search together was to find out mainly if she was alive and what kind of life she had. And I really would not have needed anything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't. We didn't want to be the ones to, break the news to her that this took place.
Right. So once you did find her, then just tell us about the process of feeling that relief and then why you decided to put this in a book form.
After the reunion, we had inquiries. The story in the newspaper went to USA Today. It went to all over the internet and still is today. And we've had inquiries from people all over the world wanting no more information. And this story is really a testimony to God's protection, God's guidance, and God's grace. And by that, what I mean, God's protection. That infant baby, 2 to 5 days old, cut up by the barbed wire fence, lying in the cold rain for almost 24 hours, animals in the woods that would have loved to have found her, bleeding, cut, like I said, and covered with maggots. She survived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
6.5 pounds. She had to be protected.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to have a guardian angel, or God himself was there. And then when I refer to God's guidance, I was a 14-year-old boy, and I walked this distance along the fence, and I had to stop at that fence post and climb that fence post, and that's where she was lying. If I had stopped anyplace else, she would still be there.
Right.
And then God's grace is he reunited her with me so I could find out what kind of life she had. And that was a wonderful, wonderful day.
I bet. I saw the pictures and everything on your website. And yes, it looked like it was just such a happy, happy reunion. And it's just so interesting how your life was so intertwined with this other person's. And it just seems so random, and yet it really isn't.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Gail, tell us about the book writing process, because this, I'm sure you had heard this story since you had met Dave, and that had to have been really an emotional yet cathartic adventure for the two of you together, for him to tell you about this and for you to put this in book form. So let's just talk about how that process occurred.
You know, Dave told me the story before we were married during our engagement period. We had a very short engagement period of 2 weeks. 3 months later, we were married, and we just celebrated our 51st anniversary. But during our engagement was when he first told me the story. I mean, I was astounded. I couldn't believe anybody's first time I'd even heard of something this horrific. But, of course, I dedicated to Dave that I would help him search for her also. He had searched already with his grandparents for 10 years. trying to find out something about her. When David got out of the Army, his grandparents turned over newspaper clippings of the articles that came out in 1955, hand them over to him in an old envelope. We still have the originals here at our home. Told him to keep them, to keep searching, and they felt the articles would be important. And I am so blessed and thankful that they did that because of what we mentioned before, all the brick walls that we kept running into, denials, nobody would tell us anything. Some of them, one time the newspaper article denied the story, and we're sitting here with all the originals in our hands.
Oh, my.
So that was a very, very important thing. A lot of things happened during the research of our book that we really do feel there was some type of cover-up for whatever reason of this baby in her life. But, of course, we started searching at that point in time, no internet or anything. We would write letters. We would go up to Indiana every few years in the beginning and talk to friends to see if they'd ever heard anything, go into some of the newspaper articles, the courthouses and things, trying to find out. We couldn't ever uncover anything. And then we raised two sons in between, so we got busy with that, but Roseanne never left David's mind, never left my mind. We just continued to search. When the internet came in, we continued to search that way. All we had was her name that the social workers had given her in the hospital, which was Roseanne Lane. Of course, her name was changed when she was adopted. But we never had that information. But we kept searching and searching. Never thought about writing a book in the very beginning because we never knew how the story would turn out. We had a very good friend, Suzanne Freiman, a story about her in the book. She helped us try to find Roseanne for 7 years. And God's timing had her at a reunion party with a bunch of other people, and somebody brought up the question. They were reminiscing. Somebody brought up the question if anybody had ever heard whatever happened to that baby that was found in the woods so long ago. Of course, she just stood up and was so excited and said she's been trying to help the man who's trying to find her. In that audience of guests was the son of the town marshal who was the first one on the scene in 1955. So she told us about him, and we wrote him and asked him to search his dad's files. He had already passed away, and he couldn't find out anything, but he gave us a different name to contact, which this man was a retired sheriff. His name was John Cady. Suzanne had already talked to John Cady 7 years prior to that on our behalf, trying to get him to do some investigative work, and he couldn't find out anything. Same thing, brick walls, you know, nothing given. Nothing found. And so when we came back to that name, David really was ready to give up. He said, we've tried this. It didn't work out. I'm tired. And he wanted to stop. I let him stew for a couple of days, and I wrote a letter, and I just put it in front of him, and I just said, Dave, just write one more time. Let's try. And so he did. We nailed it. 2 days later, John called us on the phone. David was driving, and I took the phone call for him. And we were on 75 going to Knoxville, and Dave said, well, I'll call you when we stop. We'll turn off. And he did. And John Cady just really gave him the third degree all the way through about different things, making sure he was indeed the man who found the baby and not somebody just trying to, again, grab a hold of a story and make it something it wasn't. And he told David at the end of the conversation he wanted to give him his very own Christmas miracle. And on December 21st of 2013, he called us. He had called us every few days or written us by email every few days to let us know about lack of any type of information, dead ends, everything, giving us names and numbers. Well, this day he called, and he told David to write down his name and this number, and didn't tell him what it was in the beginning, so David did that. I was standing next to Dave right on our kitchen island, and Dave said, "Okay, John, who's this?" And John said, "That's your little girl. I found her." Dave just just had to grab on. I had to grab on to him.
Mm-hmm.
John told David, "Give me a minute. Let me let her know that you're going to call her." And so he did that. And Dave called Ellen about 5 minutes later. Broke up as soon as he heard her voice. David followed me, and I wasn't much better. But we talked, and David kind of controlled himself a little bit more and got back on the phone and talked to her some more. And after that, we started a lot of email conversations, and we knew they wanted to plan a reunion up in Indiana, just a private one, just a small one. But unknowing to us at that point in time, John had already handed over his investigative reports to the hometown newspaper up there, the Palladium Item. So the Palladium started calling us right afterwards to interview Dave and to talk to him. But the day that that newspaper was published was March 2nd of 2014. He interviewed both Dave and Ellen and included the investigative reports from John. We knew it was coming out. We looked at it on the internet, and wonderful article, front page, two other pages. And we thought that was great. At the same time we were reading it, a neighbor of ours put out an email to our development saying this is a story about our own Dave Hickman, everybody read it. And we thought, at first, she was a native of Richmond, Indiana also. But when we looked at the link, it was the USA Today. Could not believe it. We went to church. When we came back, our phone was ringing off the hook. From NBC, CBS, ABC, Women's World, World News from the UK, everybody was calling to try to get the full rights to the story and the full rights to the interview of reunion. We gave the rights to CBS to cover the reunion. So media from New York City, CBS, ABC, all came down, networks from NBC in Dayton, Ohio, Indianapolis, Indiana, and New York came down to cover the event, as well as the newspapers from all the surrounding cities of Richmond, Indiana. The reunion was broadcast on the CBS This Morning Show the very next day, and they also put it on YouTube. Once all of that started coming about, it really did, as you said, it went viral around the world, and we were getting comments. I started a scrapbook for David, and I had to quit. It was just too big. Tens and tens of thousands of comments from people, all recognizing that this was God's divine intervention, and that this was a miraculous, incredible story. But once we started doing that, and we went to the reunion, once the reunion was over, people were just talking again about how this needs to be a book. Now, I'd never written a book before. I'd written lots of poems, as a youth. And I was always good with grammar and spelling. I mean, I was even a kid that liked to read the dictionary and look at the words and read what they meant. I did that a lot. But maybe I could, do this. But I didn't know how to start. And the saying, you don't know what you don't know. So I started researching the internet to find out how to get started writing a story. One of the things I came across was an article by Karen Kingsbury, and it was her 10 tips for aspiring authors. Now, she's a number one New York best-selling author. She lives right here in Tennessee. But she had 10 things on her list, two of them, the first and the second. The first one was Keep Writing. It says, if God has given you a book to write, or if you feel he has placed a story on your heart that needs to be told, write, write, write. The tenth thing that she said was pray. Nothing written or done for God will happen without your diligent prayer. A lot of things in between also to help. But those were the two things I needed to hear, the first and the last. I should have stopped right there and started writing the story. But I kept searching the internet for more information, and the more I read, the more scared I became, the more frozen my mind became, and the more negative I became about my own ability, you know, could I even do this story, you know? But the message needed to be heard. So I started the writing actually on June 4th of 2014. At first, when I wrote the book, I tried to work Faye's story and Ellen's story in together, to mingle it. And it just, it didn't work. The words weren't coming easily to me, and it just didn't seem like a good flow. Again, I kind of started doubting myself again. And at that point, we started trying to use some other authors, ghostwriters and columnists, to maybe do the book. But what we got back was more their story and not us. It just wasn't the emotional and uplifting and inspirational story that we knew this one was. So again, David came up to me and after about a year, and said, you need to write the story. And he was right, because I was right by his side for decades. And it was in my heart, the story was in my soul. This time it felt right, and I felt that God's grace would guide us on this venture.
Right.
And this was Dave's story and our story, and we felt it was God's timing. Once I made that decision, I knew I was going to stick with it. And I went to the computer. My hands would not keep up with the words. They just kept flooding into my mind. I kept notepads everywhere with me to jot down things. But 58 years of memories for Dave and 48 for me. And I prayed every morning for the story. I gave thanks every night for the words that God provided to me. I finished the first rewrite in 4 months. And then turned it over to a Christian neighbor of ours who edited it, which was a wonderful working experience. And once we finalized it and I rewrote, it was time to find a publisher. I knew I didn't want to do a traditional publisher. You know, I thought the story was too important. And this message of God's miracles were too powerful, and they needed to be told now and not years later. Well, Dave started researching the internet for Christian self-publishing companies. We knew we wanted a Christian one. And the second one he came across was Zulon Press. When he told me about Zulon, then I went over and started doing some research also. And like what I saw, Zulon's an ancient Greek word that's found in the Bible. John the Apostle uses the word Zulon to describe the Book of Life and the Tree of Life. In Revelation 22. And Zulon states on their website, their mission is to add names to God's Book of Life through the books that they publish. Well, that just sold it for me. I called up, and we talked to the marketing person. Her name was Kimberly Ludwig. And she told me a little bit about Zulon and their process, and then she asked me about the book. I started telling her about the story of a young hunter, 14 years old, in the woods, Indiana, September, climbing a fence post. Briefly told her about everything. When I got to telling her about the fence post, she stopped me. And she said, Gail, is this the story of a 14-year-old who has found a baby in the woods up in Indiana? And I said, yes, it is. And she was so excited. She said, I've got to tell my director about this story. She said, I've read this. It came across my Facebook a couple months ago. Well, you know, we knew then God placed us right in their hands. And it was published on March 23rd, 2016, being represented all over the world. It was a Book Expo America just this past May 31st through June 2nd. And it's going to be at the International Christian Retailers Show in Cincinnati on June 27th through the 30th. And the story really is tragedy ended up as a fairy tale, and it's touching people all over the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. You just had divine intervention at every turn, and this just was a journey that was meant to be for all of you, apparently. And I think it's a message of hope and faith and belief. And I'm so happy that this has a happy ending, that you were able to be reunited and be able to get this message out to folks.
Well, could we take just a moment, and David would read the message that he gave to Ellen when he presented three roses to her, if that was possible?
Absolutely, yes.
The reunion was more or less billed as the first meeting of Ellen and I together. In all reality, that was like my third reunion with her. Finding her in the woods, of course, the first one. The second one was when the two nurses brought her to me at my school. And the third one, of course, the reunion in Richmond, Indiana, my hometown, covered by CBS. Before the reunion, Ellen had asked me to take her to the woods where I found her. And after talking to her and finally getting down a level where I could really communicate with her, I had to put things into perspective as to what really took place. So I wrote down the three roses. And the day before the reunion, of course, we drove up, had the family behind her following us up, and I stopped at the location where I found her, and I tied three ribbons, pink ribbons, to the fence. And that's where I was going to take Ellen to show her where she was found. That area has not changed for all these years. But the three roses was something I wrote up to put things into perspective as to what really took place. And if you don't mind, I'll read that to you.
Please do.
At the reunion, I carried in three pink roses. And I had Ellen sit down, and I wrote this for a redness to her. The first rose is for a little baby girl left in the woods that God led my grandfather and me to find. And I gave her the first pink rose. The second rose is for a little baby girl named Roseanne, who was brought to me by two angels of mercy to say goodbye to. The third rose, or I gave her the second rose at that time. Then the third rose is for a very special lady saved by the hand of God, and I handed her the third rose.
There was not a dry eye in that moment that he made this presentation.
I know, I'm feeling it right now. Wow, I am so feeling so blessed that I met the two of you and that we are able to share this just heart warming story for our listeners. And there's more to know, and I don't want to tell any more of the story just because I want folks to get a copy of the book. But thank you so much for sharing this today. Give us your website so we can send folks to find more information.
Okay. Our website is www.andtheangelcried.com. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iBook, through our publisher. And there you can see that also on our website with links. I'm also a member of the Authors Guild of Tennessee, and they have a beautiful website, authorsguildoftn.org. And you can go and read a little bit of blogs from me and from all the other authors. There's some beautiful people that are out there writing books of all different kinds of genres. I hope that people, when they come to the website, when they read about the story, that they're touched with the story. And if they are, that they share with their friends and with their family. We just want the message of God's miracles to reach out as far into the world as possible, because they're there every day if we just stop and pay attention, be quiet, and act upon them and recognize them. they're there.
Right. There's always hope. And obviously, Dave, you are a messenger to that message as well, to say that there is always hope, that you held that out for all these years. I want to thank you both from the bottom of my heart for spending some time with us today to share this beautiful story. And God bless both of you. Thank you.
God bless you.
God bless you, Pat. Wonderful talking to you.